We're going to investigate this morning what happened at the cross. What exactly happened at the cross? And I know it's easy to look at different things. It's easy to look at the fact that a good man died. It's easy to look at the fact that an innocent man was punished for something that he didn't do. We could even look at it and see the Son of God being handed over, as it was said, to the Romans. There's a lot of different angles that we could come at with this. What I want to do is I want to look at what happened at the cross, and I want to use the things that Jesus said while he was on the cross to analyze exactly what was going on. Because I think there's a lot in what he had to say as it relates to what was going on multiple levels. So we're going to do that this morning, and we're going to look at what happened at the cross. Now, we're going to be moving back and forth between the different gospel accounts. And we're going to start there in Luke 23, verse 34. In Luke 23, verse 34, Jesus says, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." One of the first things we think about when we think about the cross is forgiveness from sin. Now, this is an interesting statement because think of all of the suffering that Jesus had already been through. The beating, the whipping, the crown of thorns, the robe being pulled on and off, walking with that crossbeam as far as he could until he collapsed, the insults, the hitting, the spitting on him, the berating, the questioning, all of the things that he'd already been through. And the first thing he does when he's on the cross is he forgives the very people that are doing that. In the midst of his suffering, the heart of Jesus is focused on others rather than on himself. And isn't that what he said over and over? "I came to serve, not to be served." Here we see the nature of his love, unconditional and divine. Unconditional in that he's willing to forgive these people even though they really don't care whether they ask for forgiveness or not. They really don't care. But he's willing to forgive them anyway. And divine in that he calls upon his Father, the one God that is able to forgive sin, and begs him, "Forgive them. They don't understand what they're doing." The next thing we see Jesus say is in Luke chapter 23, verse 34. And we see a measure of his salvation. And Jesus said to him, the one thief that seemed to have a sense of reality, a sense of repentance, a sense that he was about to die for something he had done, but this man next to him is about to die for something he didn't do. And he recognizes who he is, at least as far as that he is going to be a king and have a kingdom. I can't tell you whether he really understood. I doubt that he did, because very few, if any, did. But at the very least, he understood Christ's authority and that he truly was a king. And so he asks Jesus that when he comes into his kingdom, can he take him? And Jesus says to him in verse 43, "Assuredly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise." One of the criminals that was crucified with Christ had recognized who Jesus was and expressed faith in him as a Savior. Here we see his grace. His grace poured out through faith. as Jesus assured the dying man of his forgiveness and of his eternal salvation. Something only Jesus could convey or allow, provide for him. We see this salvation that we all cling to through his blood that was shed, that we've talked about. Salvation on the cross. You know, a lot of times we think of salvation coming after the cross, but here we actually see salvation during the process, while Jesus was on the cross. In John chapter 19, verses 26 and 27, Jesus, while he is on the cross, is also very aware of everything that's going on around him. And it says, when Jesus therefore saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing by, he said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son." Then he said to the disciple, "Behold your mother." I think we probably understand who was the disciple who Jesus loved. John. That's pretty easy to establish from other scriptures and from John's own accounts himself. So, Jesus, hanging on the cross, looks down and was still, even though he's going through all of this and the immense implications of what is going on, he is still filled with the concerns of a son, the eldest son, for the earthly needs of his mother. None of his brothers does he trust to care for her. They have not really been following. Maybe a little bit at the end, but maybe they will and maybe they won't. None of his brothers are there to care for her. So he gives this task to a trusted apostle, the one whom he loved. And we're told that from that moment on, John cared for her as if she was his mother. As the oldest son, there was a lot of responsibility on Jesus in this society and under the laws. I see that before Jesus ever started preaching, his father was dead. He was gone. And as a result of that, Jesus was left with the care of his mother. And we do see his mother, perhaps for other reasons, but we do see his mother traveling with him quite a bit, don't we? He was caring for her. He was making sure she had what she needed. And as a result of this, he understands that in their society, she very well could be left to fend for herself. And so he makes sure that somebody he trusts will care for her. Now, I do believe that several of his brothers became disciples, didn't they? And became followers. We have many records of them turning to him and understanding finally who he was and believing in him. And perhaps at that point, they also helped take care of Mary, but we don't know. But we do know that we can see Jesus' concern for her welfare, even in the midst of everything else that's going on. We can clearly see Christ's love for his mother. In Matthew chapter 27, verse 46, Matthew records, "And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, 'Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani,' that is, 'My God, why have you forsaken me?'" Here we see the darkest hours of his suffering. The agony, the physical toll that this is taking on him as a human being. The spiritual toll. Have you ever done something wrong and you felt bad about it? You had that guilt, that concern that you felt, that weight of the sin that is described to us in the scriptures? Have you ever felt that weight for somebody else? a spouse or a child or a brother or sister, a parent, somebody you care about and are close to, you know that they have done something wrong and you feel that same weight of that sin. It bothers you. Can you imagine the weight of the sin of everybody in the congregation? Can you imagine the weight of the sin of everybody in your city? The weight of the sin of everyone in the state, in the United States. You see where I'm going? The weight of the sin of everybody living in the world. How immense would be the weight of the sin of everybody that had ever lived and was ever going to live? Every single lie, every falsehood, every theft, every murder, every deceit, everything, every sin that man has ever committed or ever will commit laid right on your shoulders. Jesus, at this point, when he is feeling all of the weight of these, the physical and the emotional agony that he is having, he cries out with the opening words of Psalm 22, a psalm that David wrote about the crucifixion. And I know that there has been many different suggestions regarding the meaning of all of this, but it is quite apparent that it expresses the agony that Jesus felt as he understood the separation that he had from God. A separation, something that he had never perceived in any form. Think about that. He had never felt apart from his Father. He had always been in the presence of the Father. He and the Father had always been of one mind. He always knew exactly what the Father wanted him to say, exactly what the Father wanted him to do. The Spirit guided him through every minute detail of his life. And right now, on the cross, he feels that separation. That separation that we know, we understand about, because our sin has separated us from our God. But Jesus had never felt that before. But because of the sin that he's bearing, he feels that separation. He experiences that. And it causes him to cry out in agony. In John chapter 19, verse 28, it says, after this, Jesus, knowing that all things were now accomplished, that the scripture might be fulfilled, said, I thirst. Now, do you think this is the first time that he'd been thirsty? How long had he gone without something to drink? How long had his mouth been parched by the pain that is coursing through his body? How long had he desired just a little bit of relief? You remember that Jesus had refused the initial drink when they were getting ready to put him on the cross, when they were getting ready to drive the nails. They had offered him, you remember, something to drink. That was a light sedative, really, is what that was. And Jesus refused that. He refused the initial drink of vinegar and gall and myrrh that was offered to calm the victim so that they were more easily dealt with and handled as they struggled against the nails. Jesus had refused that because he needed to keep his wits about him. You know, as the Son of God, with the power that he held in just simply a word or a thought, imagine what he could have done if in a moment of weakness he had cried out in vengeance, cried out for relief, cried out for the angels to come and save him. But here, several hours after that, we see Jesus fulfilling a messianic prophecy that's found in Psalm 69:21, where it says, "They also gave me gall for my food, and for my thirst gave me vinegar to drink." He now accepts that liquid because it was prophesied. He must. He had to at some point accept that. But in this, I think we can see his suffering. He has reached the point where he needs a little bit of relief and to fill this prophecy. In John chapter 19, verse 30, "So when Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, 'It is finished.' And bowing his head, he gave up the spirit." Jesus knew that this crucifixion was for a purpose. He had lived his entire physical life on the earth for this purpose, to complete this task. Earlier in John 10:18, he'd said of his life, "No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have the authority to lay it down and authority to take it up again. This command I receive from my Father." He was in control. He was in charge. Even though horrible things were being done to him, he was still in control. He was still in charge. And these three words, "it is finished," are packed with meaning. When we really stop and think about what it was that was finished, what could he have been talking about? What was finished? Christ's earthly physical life was finished. His time here on earth, where he had to feel pain, where he had to feel disappointment, where he had to feel hunger, where he had to feel tired, where he was limited in some ways by his physicalness, it was done. He was done with that part of his existence. His suffering on our behalf was finished. It was about over. He was not going to feel the pain anymore. The payment for sin and the redemption of the world was finished. The price had been paid. The cost had been given. No more sacrifice for sin would be needed. No more price or cost owed. He'd paid it all. The very reason and purpose he came to the earth was finished. His goal had been achieved. He had conquered Satan. His final act of obedience was completed. He had been obedient all his life, and now this last horrible, difficult thing that God had asked of him was over. All the prophecies had been fulfilled. The prophecies of his birth, of his life, of the work he would do, of the things he would say, of the people that would be around him, of the places he would go, of the way he would die, and the people involved in that, and all the details, even down to drinking that sour wine, that vinegar mixed with gall. It all was finished. All the prophecies had been fulfilled. And in that process, the entirety of the old Mosaical law and the patriarchal law was done. All of the old laws were finished, and God in this life and in this act had brought them together in one new law, right? The law of Christ. All of the past was over. And a law of justice and mercy and love and forgiveness was now in place. When he said, "It is finished," he meant a lot. There were a lot of things that were done and over, completed. He said, "I did not come to destroy the law, but to fulfill it, to finish it, to put it away." And finally, in Luke chapter 23, verse 46, And when Jesus cried out with a loud voice, he said, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. Having said this, he breathed his last. Complete trust in the Father. Complete and total trust in the Father. You know, he said it was finished, and there were many, many things that we talked about that was finished. But there was one last thing that had to happen, wasn't there? Because without it, all of this would have been for naught. He had to come back to life. He had to be resurrected from the dead. That too was prophesied. That too was foretold, and that too was required. Because if he didn't come back from the grave, this is one of the reasons I think that Satan is not all-knowing. Because if Satan was all-knowing, he would have done everything he could to keep Jesus alive. Because the moment that Jesus died, Satan lost. Permanently. Because he was not going to be able to keep him in the grave. The wages of sin, Satan's realm, is death. But the gift of God, something Satan can't control, is life. Here as his life closes out, Jesus closes with the words of Psalm 31:5. It's a psalm that David wrote, which focuses on trusting God and relying him to help in difficult circumstances. What a perfect psalm for Jesus to recount and remember. Jesus is about to physically die. His body is going to be put in the tomb. His spirit goes to the spirits. And he is eventually going to come back to life. His spirit will re-enter his body and he will physically rise from the grave. Talk about trust in his Father. He had to have complete and total trust that God would take care of this, that this would be done, that he did have the power to do this. We see his complete trust in the Father, and Jesus entered death the same way that he lived every day of his life, offering up his life as a perfect sacrifice and placing himself in the hands of his Father. There was a lot that went on that cross, isn't there? And there's probably even more things that we could talk about, but I just chose to use those seven statements and investigate what exactly happened. Because we think about this, we talk about this, we analyze this, but think about all the things that happened. There was forgiveness. There was salvation. There was concern for others. There was agony that he was suffering through that whole time. There was completion of many different things, and there is evidence, bright evidence of complete and total trust in the Father. If we are honest with ourselves, we go through these same things throughout our whole life, don't we? We are supposed to have that kind of forgiveness. We are supposed to have that kind of concern. We are supposed to seek out that salvation and help others find it. We are going to feel the agony of our sin, and it should affect us. We're going to suffer. Jesus told us that. If we are serving him, then yes, we will suffer. But we can experience completion of the tasks that God has given us to do while we're here. But that is only all possible if, like Christ, we are able to fully and completely entrust ourselves over to the Father, to trust in him to guide us, to trust in him for salvation, to trust in him for that hope. What do you take from the lessons from the cross? You know, the most important thing that happened there was that Jesus paid that cost for our sin. There's nothing I can do. There's no good that I can have done. How much good does it take to outweigh a sin? I don't know the answer to that question, but I'm pretty sure that the Bible instructs me that no amount of good I can do can outdo the sin that I commit, even one sin. We're told that our filth and our righteousness is like filthy rags. All the good that I can do is absolutely worth nothing. Even if I only committed one sin and the rest of my life was good deeds, it's still not enough. The only thing that can give me the righteousness I need, the righteousness of God, is the sacrifice of Christ. He made Him who knew no sin to be sin for us, that we might become the righteousness of God in Him. That through Jesus, I can have the righteousness of God, because my own righteousness is worthless. If I could do good deeds my entire life and not counteract one sin, what in the world could I do to counteract all the sin throughout my entire life? There is nothing. There is nothing. So Jesus paid that cost right there. He paid that cost so I wouldn't have to, but because I can't. Because there's literally nothing that I can do. So He paid that cost and offers me and you salvation, a clean heart, purity, the righteousness of God through Him. If you're ready to accept that righteousness, we invite you to come forward as we stand and sing the song that's been announced.